You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Deja Vu by Brian Stelter. I learned a lot about Trump when it originally aired, but now is there anything truly new to learn about the man? Repeats can be as distressing as they are enticing. I had so many flashbacks to 2016 while watching the recent Redux, said Amanda Carpenter, Ted Cruz's former communications director turned never-Trump crusader. Carpenter was a paid CNN commentator back when I anchored the network's Reliable Sources program. She told me she thought CNN organized the town hall as a sweetener, an entree to Donald Trump to say, please let us be part of the 2024 political process. At what cost? While some critics credited Collins for fact-checking, the smartest takes on the night argued that checking Trump doesn't have that effect. The conflict and his bullying of the journalist is the essence of the performance, Washington Post opinion writer Paul Waldman tweeted afterward. It says, we will create our own reality. You have no power over us. And the more frustrated you get, the more we win. That's what was happening when Collins, having interjected truth into yet another Trump yelp, said, the election was not rigged, Mr. President. You can't keep saying that all night long. You cannot keep saying the election was rigged. But Trump could keep saying it, and he did. Collins was not shaken by the spectacle, even when Trump called her nasty, but plenty of her CNN colleagues were perturbed on her behalf. After a late-night private flight home from Manchester, New Hampshire, CNN CEO Chris Licht tried to quell an employee rebellion by telling them that the Trump encounter made a lot of news, a familiar 2016 defense, and that covering Trump will continue to be messy and tricky, but it's our job. He justified the town hall by implicitly raising the idea of political memory loss. Town hall viewers, he said, know what the stakes are in this election in a way that they didn't the day before. The stakes have proved high for Licht, too, who lost his job following Tim Alberta's damning Atlantic profile that outlined a year of fumbles. Have memories of Trump's misconduct already faded? Do memories perhaps need to be jogged? I'm inclined to say yes, since so many news executives and political analysts appear to have succumbed to revisionist history, downplaying Trump's destruction of a shared reality and his shredding of democratic norms. It's hard to even recall that sliver of time after January 6th, when it seemed like Trump was being excommunicated from American politics. Now he has been fully welcomed back, including by media executives who say they want to rebuild trust by sticking to facts, not opinions. But it wasn't an opinion that Trump lied, smeared, and obstructed justice. In the words of NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen, the takeover of right-wing politics by MAGA created a lies and fictions crisis that could not be met within the both sides' comment on a common set of facts system as it then stood. And so the media manipulation continues, even though many individual journalists know better. There will be more town halls, more tiffs, more reruns of reruns. CNN's Trump town hall netted 3.3 million viewers, far fewer than most media experts expected, which I interpret as another sign of Trump fatigue. Normies just don't care. On the other hand, 3.3 million viewers made CNN number one across cable news for the night, so it was curious how the network held off on promoting the win. Trump sensed this reluctance and said the network was traumatized by what took place at the town hall. I think that instead of acting the way they did, they should have said, we had a tremendous ratings night, one of the best in years, many years, and spiked the football, right? One day after Trump declared victory over CNN, I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a Harvard Kennedy School Congress. Seated across from me for dinner was Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark and founder of Republican Voters Against Trump. The town hall was all anyone wanted to talk about. I thought it was a wake-up call, she said. People need to understand that this is who we're up against. Longwell has a superpower, and she derives it from the GOP voter focus groups that she convenes in battleground locations. She is able to translate their gripes and grievances into Harvard speak. In the focus groups, it's all about vibes, she said that night, and the voters are all in on his vibes. With the first primary election of 2024, months away, Longwell sees an available audience to move past Trump within the GOP. But you can't beat something with nothing, she said, and there's no one to fill that void right now. Ron DeSantis and Dino Robert F. Kennedy Jr. don't appear to be cutting it. Reruns are effective when memories are short. And let's recognize, as we all careen toward the 2024 contest, that some Republican leaders are engaged in a systematic memory-holing effort. They reduce all the Trump objections to a distaste for his mean tweets. Speaking as someone who was on the receiving end, the tweets were among the least controversial aspects of his time in office. The real scandals barely seemed to matter, though, while America was binge-watching Trump. As Amazon and Disney know all too well, both love-based and hate-based binges keep audiences glued to the screens. Another proof point, when Carlson was still on Fox, the network boasted that he had more Democrat viewers than MSNBC had. It is the freshly fired Carlson, the one person who could transform the 2024 election from an encore into an all-new episode? I wouldn't go that far, but Longwell pointed out that both he and Trump have created cult-like bonds with audiences. They've both convinced voters that they are the only ones who are telling the truth. These voters and cable news viewers both skew older. The parallel industries of politics and television distinctly feel, to borrow a phrase from one of cable's cringiest episodes of 2023, past their prime. Don Lemon, 57, was wrong to apply the phrase to Nikki Haley, 51, and he lost his job soon afterward. But the media can't shy away from the age conversation. It is paramount in younger voters' minds. Sagar Anjety, 31, the co-host of the anti-establishment YouTube show and podcast Breaking Points, told me that the traditional media, hamstrung by access and selective love for norms, is unable to channel the rage the vast majority of Americans under the age of 65 feel at seeing a rematch of two people who should be in a retirement home. Reruns take advantage of our brain's weaknesses. With The Office, I have forgotten many of the calamities and contrivances that make up a typical season, so watching anew feels fresh. But I still recall enough to know that Steve Carell's boss character, Michael Scott, leaves the show during season 7. As a re-viewer, I anticipate those plot twists and appreciate the story more fully when they happen. Political reporters think much the same way about covering experienced candidates. They know the trajectory of previous campaigns and look for deviations from the default rollout. Witness the delirium about DeSantis starting his campaign by chatting with Elon Musk on Twitter Spaces, which turned out to be a disaster. But theoretically, at least, replays educate the viewer. And in similar fashion, the median voter is far better equipped to examine the political parties and associated propaganda than they were the first time Trump ran. Consider Fox, which was still clinging to its fair and balanced slogan back in 2016. Media reporters who would describe Fox as conservative could expect to field a phone call from an offended flack. The arguments didn't hold up then, and Fox does not even try to make them now. Dominion Voting Systems' now settled lawsuit against Fox exposed Rupert Murdoch's use of his media properties to help the GOP win elections, something that had been presumed but never really documented before. In one September 2020 email with Carl Allen, then the editor of the New York Post, Murdoch asked, "How can anyone vote for Biden?" Reading the missive now, I can't help but think about all the Murdoch media denouncements of rival outlets' alleged biases. Murdoch had as big a blind spot as any so-called liberal elite. His only hope is to stay in his basement and not face serious questions, Allen replied. It might just work. Murdoch messaged that he just made sure Fox is banging on about these issues. If the audience talks, the theme will spread. Or not. When Trump lost 2 months later, Murdoch did not indulge the big lie like so many of his employees. He wanted to chart a course back to reality. After Fox and the other major networks called the election for Biden, Murdoch bemoaned Rudy Giuliani as a terrible influence on Donald and wanted to get through to Trump about it. He wrote to Allen, "Should we say something Donald might see?" Thanks to Dominion, Murdoch's hidden hand is now undeniable, but his grip is weakening as Musk elevates Twitter as a platform for previously banned far-right voices. Now known as X, the Daily Wire escalates an anti-trans culture war, and Carlson plots ways to exact revenge against Fox. Schisms are forming between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Some Republican office holders are whispering that Trump is too toxic to win in a general. In other words, it's 2016, the sequel. The people who would know best about the art of the sequel, my Hollywood writer friends, began the summer by picketing. It was the first writer strike in 16 years, and it jogged my memory about Trump's reality TV past. In 2007, when NBC and other networks had to make backup programming plans for a potential strike, The Apprentice was thought to be, if not dead, then close to retirement. NBC Entertainment President Kevin Reilly admitted that the show's future was up in the air, saying, "Donald's been declared dead before in many ways. It's news he'll never accept on any front." But the ratings had eroded bigly, from sensational first season average of 21 million viewers to a sixth season average of under 8 million. Trump took it hard. He tried to say, "I quit," before the network could say, "You're fired," by claiming he was moving on from The Apprentice to a major new TV venture. But there was no new venture. The writer's strike meant NBC desperately needed fresh, unscripted content to replace shows like The Office, and that's what kept The Apprentice alive. Trump remained a regular primetime presence right up until he said he wanted to be president. It is his reliance on television, his addiction to TV, his obsession with TV that explains Trump more than anything else, in my experience. And it's why I feel comfortable focusing on the rerun aspects of this race. Even at the risk of turning profound threats to our republic into a ratings competition. Politics is storytelling. Television is storytelling. Trump's years in office can only be comprehended through a TV lens. It's a guessing game whether he'll show up for the summer's biggest show, Fox's GOP debate on August 23rd. And the listener should obviously know that's history by now. Biden consumes plenty of cable news, too. He just doesn't live tweet his reactions. One day last November, Biden was in Cambodia for a summit of Southeast Asian leaders and caught the A block, the opening segment of MSNBC's The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. He heard a guest say that Trump didn't change the Republican Party, he revealed it. And he repeated that line to a group of reporters half an hour later. The guest that night was Stuart Stevens, once a top strategist on Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, and now an avowed opponent of Trump. He looked at Florida's escalating book bans under DeSantis, the demonizing of Disney, the wokeism obsession, and he said Trump's rivals didn't stand a chance. "Guys, it's Trump or Biden," he told his Twitter followers after the CNN town hall. "Live in the real world. If you saw Donald Trump tonight and aren't supporting Biden, you are helping elect Trump. It's not complicated. It's the opposite of complicated. It's familiar. It's comforting. It's a rerun." War of the Rosé. They came together in a blaze of passion, then split amid a storm of recriminations. In between, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie established a hugely profitable wine label on an enchanting estate in the south of France. Now, as lawsuits continue to fly, Mark Seal uncovers the truth about the battle for Miraval. Opening photo, Paradise Lost. centuries-old wine-making haven set in its own valley, Miraval became the Julie Pitt family's escape from the glare of global fame. When the couple split, it became the subject of a brutal legal tug of war. Part 1, The Miracle. The call came in to the concierge at the Hotel du Cap Edenrock, the fabled luxury hotel on the French Riviera. It was spring 2007, and an assistant to Angelina Jolie said that Jolie and her fiancé, Brad Pitt, were seeking a sizable property in the south of France to rent. So began a glorious holiday, away from the spotlight for Jolie, Pitt, and their four children, in a sprawling chateau with a staff of 12 in the leafy glades of southwestern France. It was so idyllic that they decided to find an even bigger and more secluded property, not to rent, but to buy. Now, in June 2007, Brad Pitt sat in a twin-engine helicopter, his blue eyes scanning the verdant Provençal landscape. He and Jolie were helicopter hopping with Jonathan Gray, the real estate broker recommended by the hotel. There were six of us, two pilots, Brad and Angelina, their daughter Shiloh, who was one at the time, their American realtor, and myself, says Gray, who had arranged a top-secret three-day tour of the region. They spent their days flying from one address to the next, searching for what Pitt would later describe as a European base for our family, where our kids could run free and not be subjected to the celebrity of Hollywood. They touched down at more than a dozen properties, from cozy chateaus to vast estates, from the Riviera to Provence. Finally, on the morning of the third day, they flew over a magnificent 1,000-acre chateau and vineyard nestled in its own valley. Its name reflected its grandeur, Miraval, French for miracle. They were 50 miles east of Aix-en-Provence and just outside of the tiny town of Corne, population 830. Brad and Angelina took one look and immediately said, "Yeah, let's go see it," says Gray. Wine has been made at Miraval for centuries, the privileged domain of an Italian noble family for five generations. It was sold in 1972 to the French jazz musician Jacques Lussier. He produced red, white, and rosé wine on the estate and converted an ancient water tower into a recording studio, which attracted the likes of Sting, Chardet, and Pink Floyd, who recorded their 1979 hit album, The Wall, there. In 1992, Miraval was purchased by a U.S. Naval Academy engineering graduate named Tom Bove and his family for approximately $5 million. Bove had made a fortune in water treatment before catching what he calls the wine bug. He ramped up the estate's winemaking operation, turning out a small selection of vintages, including Pink Floyd Rosé, which he launched in 2006. Now, Miraval was on the market. Bove, whose wife had died, was ready to move on. Suddenly, a helicopter descended and outstepped two of the world's biggest superstars. Pitt extended his hand for a shake. Jolie had Shiloh in her arms and asked for a place to change the baby, says Bove. Then Jolie, Pitt, and their brokers scouted the vast estate, a wonderland of olive and oak trees, lavender fields, a lake, vineyards on stone terraces, and ancient stone buildings, including a 35-room manor house. Bove sensed that Jolie was allowing her husband to take the lead. "She let him talk," says Bove. "From my side, she was very gentle. You read all this stuff now, but they were a very nice couple, very sweet, and obviously in love with each other." And obviously in love with Miraval. So much so that, as the morning stretched into afternoon, Bove invited everyone to stay for a meal. "Brad and I moved the tables around in the garden, and we had lunch," says Bove, "drank the wines of Miraval, which were very good, and then we toured the rest of the property." Before the party climbed back on board the helicopter, Pitt told Bove, "We'll be back." Bove didn't doubt it. It seemed like they wanted to buy it right then. Bove says Pitt then added, "This is the first place we visited where Angie is smiling." Not so long ago, there was no couple in the world bigger than Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. From the moment they met on the set of the 2005 action romance, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, their attraction was magnetic, fiery, passionate, incendiary, almost insane. Their divorce would be even fiercer in its intensity. At the center of it all is Miraval. Conceived as a family retreat, it became a high-end commercial enterprise, producing honey, olive oil, a skincare line, and music from Miraval Studios. It all began with a signature wine, Miraval Côte de Provence Rosé, whose revenues reached $50 million in 2021. Even now, impossible to write this without crying, Jolie would say of Miraval in an email she sent Pitt in 2021, 4 years after she filed for divorce. Above all, it is the place we brought the twins home to, and where we were married over a plaque in my mother's memory. A place where I thought I would grow old. But it is also the place that marks the beginning of the end of our family. The story of Miraval parallels the story of Jolie and Pitt. As their legal battle stretches ever onward, their dueling lawsuits offer competing versions of a dark and disturbing saga. In Jolie's telling, it's a tale of alcohol abuse and financial control. For Pitt, it's one of vengeance and retribution. Neither can deny its sheer dramatic force. There are echoes even of the movie that brought them together, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, in which they played a married couple per IMDb, surprised to learn that they are both assassins hired by competing agencies to kill each other. Soon after Pitt and Jolie's visit to Miraval, Bove heard from their brokers, then from lawyers and more lawyers. The overtures became ever more urgent when Jolie learned she was pregnant with twins. They wanted to be in ahead of the birth, says Bove. Through their respective holding companies, the couple purchased the property on May 8, 2008, for 25 million euros. 8 days before the deal was signed, Jolie's business manager suggested adding a doomsday clause, stipulating that should the couple ever split, each would have the right to buy the other's share of Miraval. Pitt rejected the idea, according to her cross-complaint, telling his business manager it wasn't necessary for two reasonable people. However, as a byproduct of their supposedly everlasting love, he would insist that he and Jolie later made a pact agreeing never to sell their respective interest in Miraval without the other's consent. It was a promise Jolie would deny, claiming no such agreement ever existed. Bove agreed to stay on and continue running Miraval's wine operation. He retained 220 acres to operate on his own. "I think at that moment, Brad wasn't really interested in making wine," Bove says. "He liked the idea that he'd have a vineyard, but he really left the wine thing to me." From his office, Bove watched an armada of vehicles deliver the family's possessions, vans and vans arriving with furniture, incredibly packaged by the finest movers. "All of it orchestrated by Pitt," says Bove. He came more often because he wanted to get things started with the renovation. Along with the possessions came the staff, nannies from Vietnam, the Congo, and the U.S., according to one published source, along with two personal assistants, not always in residence, a cook, a maid, two cleaners, a plongeur or busboy, and four close protection bodyguards. Extensive renovations began immediately. "More Californian as opposed to Provençal," says Bove. The ancient stone chapel became a parking area for the four-wheel all-terrain vehicles the family used to traverse the massive property. And finally came the movie stars and their growing brood of children. They joined an invasion of celebrity homebuyers in Provence that would come to include, just within a 100-mile radius of Miraval, Johnny Depp and his then-wife, Vanessa Paradis, George Lucas, George Clooney, John Malkovich, and many more. For a time, leading the pack were the most famous of them all, the couple known worldwide as Brangelina. Next photo, Estate of Grace. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie first spotted Miraval while helicopter hopping in search of a property in the south of France. In 2021, Jolie sold her half to a company controlled by a Russia-born billionaire. And there are aerial views of the property shown here. Before the fights, before the combustible court documents, before the lawsuits that have crawled through the courts, for seven long, increasingly toxic years, there was a desk. Not just any desk, but a wildly expensive lacquered desk inspired by a 1920s French design, ordered long distance by Pitt as a birthday present for Jolie. Inside one of its drawers was a special inscription by Pitt and a constellation in inlaid mother of pearl, honoring Jolie's Gemini birth sign. The desk was so special that its designer, Frank Pularo, flew from New Jersey to Miraval in May 2008 to install it personally. A furniture maker to billionaires, David Geffen, Larry Ellison, and stars Jerry Seinfeld, Robert De Niro, Pularo is also a longtime wine enthusiast. The night before the installation of the desk, he had dinner at his Provençal hotel, ordering a bottle of Miraval Red to accompany his rustic roasted pigeon. The next morning at Miraval, Pularo saw a four-wheeler roaring down the ancient Roman roads. It looked like a dust tornado swirling toward him. When it finally came to a stop, the cloud parted, and there from the back of the four-wheeler stepped Brad Pitt and his and Jolie's son Maddox. "Hey, I want to thank you for coming all this way," Pitt said as they went inside. Pularo couldn't help noticing a sketchbook filled with hundreds of Pitt's furniture drawings. As Pitt helped Pularo install the ornate desk, they discussed their shared passion for furniture, and inevitably they talked about wine. When Pularo said he'd had a bottle of Miraval the night before, Pitt asked what he thought of it. "I said, it's a decent sort of rustic wine. It worked well with the roasted pigeon, but I don't think you're going to win any medals." And he kind of chuckled and said, "Well, I don't know much about wine, but I'd like to learn more." I said, "Rhone Valley wines are made out of the same grapes that you're using at Miraval," Pularo recalls. "I'm going to send you a bottle of wine from the Rhone Valley that would be a wonderful starting point for you to explore what could be done on your property." "Oh, that would be wonderful, but don't send it," Pitt replied. "I'll get it from you when I come back over to the U.S. In 2009, Jolie took a role in the movie Salt, which was shot in New York City. One day, Pularo's phone rang. "Hey, it's Brad. I'd like to take a drive out to see your shop." And the next day, he drove himself out in a rental car by himself. After Pitt toured the shop, Pularo retrieved a bottle from his cellar. "This is the finest wine that can be made in the region where you were living," Pularo told Pitt, handing him the bottle. "It's Chateau de Beaucassel, Chateau Neuf du Pape 1990, a wine of legend." A week or so later, Pularo received an email from Pitt. He wrote, "That wine sure was terrific, and Angie loved it too." "What wines did Brad like at that point?" I ask. "I think he liked Heineken." Jolie was delighted by the desk, the latest exhibition of affection from Pitt. It went into her office, which Pitt had painstakingly redesigned. "He wanted it exactly right for her," says Gary Bradbury, a Miraval director and head of security. "He thought the world of that woman." Miraval was a love letter to his wife and his children, providing a beautiful life for Angelina and the kids, and shielding them from the intense pressures of celebrity, says Pularo. On a wall outside the master bedroom Pitt installed 30 small screens that flashed with images and videos of the children in various stages of development. He built a petting zoo and filled it with rabbits, goats, chickens, and peacocks. He was just completely committed to making Miraval as great as it could be, says Pilaro. Under Pilaro's guidance, Pitt assembled a wine cellar of around 300 bottles from French vineyards. Soon, he confided in Pilaro about the state of Miraval's winemaking operations. "We're losing close to a half million euros a year," Pilaro says Pitt told him. Tom Bove insists that the wine operation was profitable when Pitt and Jolie bought it. Even more surprising to Pilaro was what Pitt said next. He wanted Pilaro to help find a solution. Pilaro assembled a list of prominent French winemakers who might serve as consultants. "I told Brad, I'm going to call these people, but they're not going to come to Provence to see Frank Pilaro, the cabinet maker. I need you to be there in person." And he said, "No problem. I want to make a world-class wine." And so the stars of the French wine world made pilgrimages to Miraval to meet the movie star. When the meetings were done, one name rose to the top. Marc Perrin, the producer of Beaucastel Châteauneuf du Pape 1990, the wine of legend that Pilaro had initially given Pitt. Perrin, CEO of the fifth-generation Perrin Wine Family Company, not only makes superb wine, but he and his family also oversee an extensive global distribution network. Arriving at Miraval, Perrin had the same sensation as everyone else. It was, he says, heaven. Awestruck by Miraval's majestic setting in its own valley, he told Wine Spectator, "A winemaker could never own this unless it was in the family for something like 20 generations. Pitt invited Perrin to sign on as a consultant. The Perrin family countered by proposing a joint venture. Pitt and Pilaro drove 100 miles north to the Rhône Valley to meet with the Perrin family at their fabled and ancient Chateau de Beaucastel. They toured the estate, and Perrin hosted a dinner with the family's 90-year-old matriarch, who opened a bottle of Chateau de Beaucastel from 1963, Pitt's birth year. As they got in the car to drive home, Pilaro recalls, "Brad said, I think this is it." Soon after that, Perrin said what would turn out to be the magic word, rosé. Once the neglected stepchild of the wine world, rosé was poised for a revolutionary rise. It had started 2 years earlier in 2006, when Sacha Lachine, son of the legendary Bordeaux winemaker and marketing wizard Alexis Lachine, bought an estate in the heart of Provence called Château d'Eclin. Lachine had long wondered why rosé champagne sold for a premium while still rosé was considered cheap and cheerful. He began experimenting with producing high-quality rosé on his estate. Late one night, he and an American friend were glowing after enjoying some rosé, he says, when they experienced a transcendent moment in the chateau's 19th-century chapel. Two stone cherubs, their heads close together, loomed high on the wall above them. "Look, they're whispering," said the friend. "Whispering angel," said Lachine, who instantly recognized the power of the name. Today, Whispering Angel is the number one best-selling French wine in the United States, according to one industry publication. "I said to someone, 'We've been riding the wave,'" says Lachine, "and they said, 'No, you created the wave.'" Unbeknownst to Pitt, Marc Perrin had been looking to stake a claim in rosé. "I had this kind of intuition that rosé was going to happen," he says, "and we had been looking as a family for a property to buy in Provence for 10 years before." "Tom, I'm going to go in another direction," Bove remembers Pitt telling him over the phone. "I'm going to work with Marc Perrin on something." "Brad, I don't know why you're doing that," Bove remembers responding. "I thought Miraval was special, and Brad had enough money, and he should maintain the quality of the wine we were producing," Bove says today. When he bought Miraval, we were doing 150,000 bottles of high-quality wine sold in very high-quality restaurants. Brad and Mark Perrin take that 150,000 bottles and run it up to 10 million. He sighs, anyway, vineyards are like your babies, and you always think your babies should go in a certain direction. Looking at the success that Miraval has had, commercially speaking, it was a brilliant idea to combine Brad and Angelina's star power and the distribution skills of Perrin. It just wouldn't have been my choice. Let's approach it like a film, and let's make something we can be proud of, Pitt said, after he and Jolie had tasted a variety of French rosés with Perrin to determine the flavor profile they wanted for Miraval. Most rosés are just light, Perrin would tell Wine Spectator. Our idea was that it also had to be juicy and fleshy and fresh. On March 6, 2013, the first 6,000 bottles of Miraval Rosé 2012 were offered for sale on the Miraval Provence website. In 5 hours, the offering was completely sold out. It was like strapping yourself to a rocket, Pularo says of the Perrin family's global distribution network. Every bottle came stamped with a sign of the winemaker's solidarity. Bottled by Jolie Pitt and Perrin, the label read. Their union, initially so fruitful, would quickly sour. On September 19, 2016, Jolie filed for divorce, citing irreconcilable differences and petitioning for custody of their 6 children. It was the opening shot of a war seemingly without end, and at its center was their most prized asset, Miraval. Next photos, chemistry set. From the moment they met on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, pictured here, Jolie and Pitt had a fiery connection. They were our last great Hollywood couple, the New York Post eulogized after the breakup. Their lineage was Bogart and Bacall, Hepburn and Tracy, Liz and Dick, golden megastars all, with outsized love stories. They began as mere mortals. The daughter of Midnight Cowboy star John Voight and actor Marceline Bertrand, Jolie was a wild child who collected knives and aspired to be a funeral home director. At age 5, she reportedly said she intended to become an actress, a big actress. She won raves for her performance in the 1998 HBO movie Gia, whose tagline, "Everybody saw the beauty, no one saw the pain," seemed apt in light of her fraught relationship with her father. The following year, she broke big in Girl Interrupted, riding a wave of acclaim to the Oscar podium, where all of 24 years old, she accepted the award for Best Supporting Actress. By then, William Bradley Pitt was already a star. He'd arrived in Los Angeles from Springfield, Missouri, in a battered Datsun with $325 in his pocket. The astonishingly handsome son of a trucking company dad and a stay-at-home mom, he had dropped out of college 2 weeks short of graduating with a journalism degree. He told his folks that he was moving to L.A. not to act, but to go into graphic design, so they wouldn't worry. Unlike Jolie, he had no movie star dad, no contacts, nothing but a dream. He stood in the streets in a yellow El Pollo Loco chicken costume, waving a sign to beckon diners inside, and drove exotic dancers to their stripogram appointments. Then Billy Baldwin dropped out of the 1991 feminist road picture Thelma and Louise to do the firefighting movie Backdraft. Tapped as a last-minute replacement, Pitt set his scenes ablaze as a hunky hitchhiker who hooks up with Gina Davis before taking off with her cash. In May 2000, Jolie, then 24, married 44-year-old Billy Bob Thornton in Las Vegas. That July, Pitt married Friends star Jennifer Aniston in a $1 million wedding in Malibu. By the time Jolie and Pitt met 4 years later on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Jolie and Thornton had divorced, though not before she adopted an orphaned baby boy from Cambodia, whom she named Maddox. Pitt and Aniston were still very much a couple until he collided with Jolie. Next photos, Grapes of Wrath. Pitt and his partner, Mark Perrin, walk Miraval's grounds. Jolie seemed to refer to this ad, shown here in court documents, saying it reminded me of painful times. Pitt and Jolie's chemistry, on and off screen, was too combustible to contain. Rumors of an affair swirled from the set, and for months after filming wrapped. In January 2005, Pitt and Aniston issued a joint statement announcing plans to split. On the weekend Aniston filed for divorce, Pitt and Jolie posed for a W Magazine portfolio shot by Stephen Klein, portraying them as a Mad Men-era married couple, complete with fictional children. In one image, Pitt pins Jolie to the bed during what appears to be an alcohol-fueled argument. "We're divorced, and you can see why," Aniston would later tell Vanity Fair. "There's a sensitivity chip that's missing." The next month, a photographer for Us Weekly magazine snapped Jolie and Pitt walking the Diani Beach on the coast of Kenya with Maddox, then 3 years old. "He just out of the blue called him Dad," Jolie would tell Vogue in 2007. "So that was probably the defining moment when he decided we would all be a family." "Brad and Angelina's secret love trip," screamed the cover line of the May 9, 2005 issue of Us. We had the worldwide scoop and the debut of Brangelina. Us publisher Jan Winner would later write, "The tipster was Angelina." Jolie and Pitt did everything big, the Post reported, adding that while they were each massive stars, together they were an epic force multiplier. And when they had sex, well, it sounded like a wounded animal, like someone being killed, read a tabloid report about their Kenyan getaway. When the noise emanating from their $2,000 a night suite was supposedly so loud that worried guards grabbed weapons and rushed to their door. Not content merely to succeed at the box office and on the awards circuit, they became international crusaders for a better world. Jolie became a special envoy for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, making dozens of field trips to global hotspots, and together they founded the Jolie Pitt Foundation to fund children's causes around the world. After moving through a succession of mega mansions and remote hideaways, they at long last found a family retreat at Miraval. They decamped to this sublime estate, where it was time for Jolie to give birth to what the media would call the Wonder Twins, Knox and Vivian. They were born at 6:27 and 6:28 p.m. on July 12, 2008, at Lamval, a seaside pediatric hospital in Nice. Almost immediately, the paparazzi descended. Magazines were waging a bidding war for rights to the first official photographs of the twins, which People and Hello magazines would share for a combined $14 million, donated to the Jolie Pitt Foundation. Meanwhile, paparazzi surrounded the hospital, vying for the first pirated photos. Just before 4 a.m. on July 19, 2008, Jolie, Pitt, and the newborn twins snuck out of the hospital in a gray Volkswagen minibus. That sent the paparazzi rushing to Miraval to await their arrival. The front gate was like the Cannes Film Festival, says Gary Bradbury, packed with paparazzi. Some photographers, clad in camouflage battle apparel, snuck onto the sacred grounds, determined to get a shot of the couple and their twins. As the photo op turned into an invasion, Pitt came outside to investigate. "What's going on, guys?" he asked, according to Bradbury. The French and British security squad swept the woods, where they found two photographers hiding beneath the dense brush. A brawl ensued with one of the photographers, who later claimed self-defense. Bradbury says he was trying to defuse the situation when the photographer hit him. He was screaming, saying he was HIV positive, and nearly bit the top of my finger off. That summer, a film director arrived at Miraval, Quentin Tarantino. He brought along the script for his World War II movie, Inglourious Basterds, hoping to talk Pitt into playing Lieutenant Aldo Raine, the tough-talking leader of a troop of Nazi-hunting soldiers. Pitt was prepared to say no, but first he broke out a bottle of wine for Tarantino. We talked about the backstory. We talked about movies till the wee hours of the night, Pitt would later say at the Cannes Film Festival. One bottle led to another, and all I know is I got up the next morning and I saw 5 empty bottles of wine lying on the floor. 5! And apparently I agreed to do the movie. 5 bottles of wine might have been unusual, but the drinking was not. Pitt once said he couldn't remember a day since I got out of college when I wasn't boozing or had a spliff or something. Something, and I'm running from feelings. I'm really, really happy to be done with all of that. I mean, I stopped everything except boozing when I started my family. In May 2013, Jolie opened up about undergoing a preventative mastectomy in the New York Times. A little more than a year later, she and Pitt were married in Miraval's ancient chapel before 20 friends, family members, and their 6 children. Maddox, then 13, Pax, 10, Zahara, 9, Shiloh, 8, and Knox and Vivian, 6. The children wrote the vows, decorated their mother's dress, and threw rose petals to celebrate the union. Miraval Rosé was served at the reception, where Jolie sipped non-alcoholic Bosnian rose petal juice. Before the wedding, as yet another token of his devotion, Pitt had given his bride something close to his heart. When they bought Miraval, Pitt had taken a 60% stake in the winemaking enterprise and the estate, while Jolie took 40%. Pitt had poured millions into Miraval, riding the rosé wave and expanding the business. Sales had grown 300%. There were waiting lists for the wine. The estate would soon have an estimated worth of $164 million. By the time of the wedding, Jolie had stopped investing, according to Pitt's court declaration, though Jolie would deny this. Nevertheless, Pitt transferred 10% of his share to her in December 2013 for the sum of £1, or €1, never paid, according to the court documents. Now they were equal partners. Part 2. The War. Very few locals in Corinne, the village outside Miraval, actually met the movie stars, but they talk about Pitt as if he were one of their own, won over by his passion for toiling in the vineyards alongside his workers, not as the boss, but as their equal. For Jolie, Miraval was a place for us to visit together and a place to hold diplomatic and humanitarian meetings, she would write. She spent much of her Miraval time in her office or in her bedroom doing UN work, says Bradbury. Pitt, meanwhile, was increasingly absorbed in winemaking and improving their historic property. I'm a farmer now, he would tell Wine Spectator. He reveled in his fields, sometimes grabbing a chainsaw and helping his team of laborers cut down dead trees and trim vines. During the reconstruction of the ancient chateau, he'd spent 8 to 12 hours a day with architects, designers, stonemasons, plumbers, and electricians, says Bradbury. At 1 o'clock, he'd tell me to give him a knock so he could get the quads ready for the children to ride on the estate. Or he would take the kids fishing on the lake, which Sting had stocked with carp during his Miraval recording sessions. He made sure he was available for his children at all times. Often, Pitt and Bradbury would put in long days of manual labor. Angie would come out and bring lunch, and we'd all sit there and have a picnic. It was very lovey-dovey, quite romantic. I used to take my sandwich and walk away. It was their time. Miraval became Pitt's secret garden, a place where he could be himself, instead of the global phenomenon known as Brad Pitt. He'd hike and jog through Miraval's roads, fields, and forest. Or he'd sit on a rock with his guitar and a smoke, his vineyard spreading out in all directions before him. He had a vision of turning Miraval into something beyond wine, an artist colony centered around Miraval Studios. On Tuesday, September 13th, 2016, the family gathered for what someone on the estate would call the Last Supper. That week, Pitt and Jolie had each flown in from far-flung locales. Pitt from the coast of Croatia, where he was developing a multi-billion-dollar ecologically responsible luxury resort. Jolie from a three-day visit to a camp in Jordan, housing 60,000 Syrian refugees. Now they were both back with their kids in the place they loved most. The family came together on the lawn, overlooking the new soccer field, beneath the gaze of stone cupids and ancient olive trees. They ate dinner at a long outdoor table. The next day, they flew off into ruin. Jolie and the children rode in their 12-passenger luxury bus to the private jet terminal in Nice, where Pitt, who had been in meetings that day on Miraval business, was waiting. After swiftly being cleared by police and customs officers, they boarded a chartered Silver Bombardier Global Express. It departed at 7:42 p.m., headed for Burbank, California. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.